Hello and welcome back to Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce.
Since I was last here, I've moved house, which I wouldn't wish on anyone, and survived Easter, which is always a bind for me because I don't eat sugar. I'm going to talk on my own here again, and I'm afraid about myself, or perhaps to be a little more accurate, what it is exactly that I do. Decades ago, I was a reporter. Then I became a news editor, then an actual editor, sort of in charge of everything, which is great. One of the things I did as editor of both the Financial Mail and then of Business Day was to make sure as far as possible to separate fact from opinion. The news pages of Business Day had the word news in large type at the bottom of the page and the words comment or opinion at the top of the editorial pages. I did, I must confess, also ask my reporters to do their best, however, when writing a news story, to insert into it their expert opinion, just briefly. That was in the good old days when I was able to hire and hold on to reporters who I insisted specialize in a beat and become sort of semi-experts in it. It wasn't difficult. Once you'd written a couple of stories about mining or materials handling or aerospace, you got to know the people and you got to know the stories and you got to know what the issues were. So from them, I invented a question and was, so what? They had to insert that right at the top of any story. And the answer to the so what question, which they had to answer, was an interpretive or an informed opinion designed to tell readers why, in their view, the story they were writing was important enough to bother writing and also, obviously, to bother reading. That was an important part of broadening the depth of news as social media and digital publications began to spread. It wasn't enough any longer to stick to the old print formula of who, what, why, when, and how. You had to tell the reader why what you were writing was important. And if you couldn't think of an answer to so what, other than that something had happened, then you were no use to me or the reader. Sadly, when I left the editorship of Business Day, so did the so what paragraph, and none of my successor editors have bothered to resuscitate it, which in my view has been a big mistake. But I digress already. Because I want to talk about what I do now, which is to write columns for the Sunday Times and Business Day and produce this podcast or record this podcast for the Financial Mail. I'm having a lot of fun, and in all honesty, it took me a long time to get here. Sometimes in the next few weeks, I'll have been a paid journalist for 50 years. It'd be nice to remember exactly when, but I can't. It's so long ago. When I was editing, we managed to make Business Day, or its opinion pages, the absolute center of debate for the body politic interested in the socio-economic debates of the time in South Africa. And I did this with my colleagues by making sure that our comment and opinion pages constantly mixed things up to get the right balance of information, considered opinion, and entertaining opinion. Whatever you do in this business, you do for the reader or the listener. Once you lose sight of that, you lose altogether. Once you become a mere dumping ground, easy to walk into, of the righteous and the worthy, you lose again. As a columnist who's not an expert in anything technical, I take my cues from one of the best of us, I think he is anyway, Matthew Paris of The Times in London. There's communism, he once wrote in a column in 2019. There's capitalism, there's conservatism, Catholicism, and there's columnism. Parks, who's a former politician-turned-columnist, was writing to warn of the menace that Boris Johnson, a columnist-turned-politician, might pose to Britain if he became Prime Minister, which he did. Paris ended up being one of his most trenchant and brilliant critics. Even when, as an enfant terrible in Brussels, Mr. Johnson called himself a reporter, he was essentially a columnist. Paris wrote in a column, headlined My Guide to the Tricks of Boris Johnson's Trade. Then as now, when he bids to be a national leader, I understand him not through acquaintance as a colleague, but in the way any dustman knows another dustman. We know each other through shared engagement in the same pursuit. Unlike real journalists, said Paris, our focus is not on reporting. And though we use facts and undertake research, our currency is opinion, our own opinion. I hope we are more than entertainers, but we are undoubtedly entertainers. I hope our art is more performance, but is at least a performance. We share with serious news reporters, however, one imperative. We must grab and keep our audience's attention. We enjoy doing this as much as any circus clown does. It's in our blood, part of our reason for being. Calvinism is striking poses which will only convince others if you yourself contemporarily inhabit the belief you're writing about. You're counsel for the prosecution or defense of an idea or dream or fear, hatred, party or politician. You take a brief, elbow doubt and ambiguity aside and go, joyously or ferociously, but always with passion and conviction, full pelt. What columnism is not is making absolutely sure first that you're right. To be frank, sometimes you rather doubt it. Columnism, said Paris, is embracing a plan or a project as a faithless man might embrace a woman, with an intensity no less sincere for being passing, ever ready to flip the project or lady once their usefulness is past. It is hugging a set of principles fiercely to your breast, while keeping a wondering eye out for some spare ones down the back of the sofa. I rather approve of this, though columns and columnists are obviously not the same thing. As an editor, I'd regularly invite experts or prominent figures to write columns in the paper, but these are one-off affairs designed to shine an informed and hopefully opinionated light onto a matter of importance at the time. Your regular columnist, on the other hand, is a machine. I have 3 deadlines a week, and in between them, I search hungrily, desperately, always anxious, for column ideas and for positions to take. One way, if you're struggling for ideas, I found, is to pick an argument with someone on the subject. Any subject. It's a way to find out what you think and to put what you might end up writing to the test. My favorite columnists here in South Africa now are Barney Mtomboti, who just about everyone I know rightly admires, and Tony Leon, perhaps a little less lovable but totally compelling nonetheless. They're serious and they're informative, and boy are they entertaining. For myself, I fuel up by picking fights and taking sides. It helps me to take a stand, though you need, obviously, to be able to move away from a point you're on if the ground beneath your feet begins to shift too much. When I endorsed Cyril Ramaphosa for the presidency ahead of the elections in 2019, my friends and my family even were completely appalled. But I'd always liked Cyril, and like a lot of people, I thought then he'd make a difference. To the extent that he has, it's been way too little and way too late. And it was the way he behaved during COVID particularly that made me move, because I felt the sand shifting under my feet. He gave far too much leeway, I thought, to Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, who brought her raw prejudices to bear against the alcohol and tobacco industries, spawning huge criminal networks in the process and crippling big employer and tax-paying industries which may never recover. Cyril was way, way too harsh on the economy. COVID would have done its damage after the first lockdown. All of his scientific advice was telling him that, and he ignored it. It wasn't politically comfortable. He carried on locking down the country, and we're paying the price, and he is too, by the way, good today. And then he did something even more appalling. When the Joburg General Hospital burnt badly in 2021, the doctors there wrote an open letter to him appealing for help in getting repairs started. The Gauteng government, which nominally runs the hospital, did absolutely nothing. And the head of surgery there told me cancer patients were being put on 5-year-long waiting lists for treatment because the facility couldn't cope. These were poor people who had nowhere else to turn. They were sick, they were needed help, and they didn't get it. Cyril didn't do a thing. And I thought that was unforgivably cruel and heartless. So yes, as a columnist, I regard changing my mind as a professional right. My unspoken deal with the editors I now work for is never to deliberately lie, never to take unseen reward for what I write, never to miss a deadline, and always to try and be entertaining. I don't know if I ever get the last thing right, but much of my considerable anxiety between columns is driven by the need to be interesting. It's not always appreciated. Many people who read columns assume I'm reporting, not merely writing. In fact, I think they read columns because they think it's part of the news. Nobody ever looks at the top of the page to see the word opinion. Be too inconvenient. The thing about opinions is that they can have theirs, but I got mine. A favorite response is to ask whether or not I should be allowed onto the pages I write on at all, if I, in whatever piece, say something they don't agree with. Just this last Sunday in the Sunday Times, I suggested that the Russian government would try to play an active part in influencing the outcome of the general election this May on the 29th. In my mind, this is just obvious, and where the ANC is concerned, positively to be expected. Most members of the ANC National Executive are actively sympathetic to Russia and actively antagonistic to the West, who they regard as capitalist, imperialist, sort of running dogs. Never mind that the Russians in their long history have probably occupied more territory by force than any other nation on earth. They didn't get to Vladivostok or remain there as they do now by bartering bearskins and, you know, being nice to people. They did it by force. The column triggered a string, nonetheless, of vituperative responses on X, or what we used to call Twitter. I had simply made it up, or worse, I'd written the piece to somehow counterbalance an apparently vital Supreme Court judgment a few days earlier, which proved, as far as they were concerned, my critics were concerned, conclusively that the Americans and not the Russians were actively interfering in our politics. Now, this may be true of the Americans. I had argued that regime change was probably no longer U.S. strategy given the disasters in Iraq and Afghanistan. Anyway, I looked at the SCA judgment, and it was so boring. Even the judge said the issue, and it was about whether or not the independent newspaper group should have access to a state security agency report on supposed American intelligence activity in South Africa. Even the judge said it seemed to be about nothing. In sum, his judgment read, this is on the report I'm supposed to have taken so seriously. In sum, the report is about the U.S. Embassy and its intelligence community, which are said to be observing the widely reported factions of the ruling party to influence domestic policy and shape the USA's own decisions. The information considered in the report is in the public domain already, said the judge. For example, the mention of certain leaders of the ANC, and I think here they're talking about Ace Magashule, it was quite a long time back, as being supporters of former President Jacob Zuma, is nothing new. Thus, there is nothing sensitive about the contents of the report. They are so banal that one could even doubt whether the conclusions said to be drawn by the U.S. intelligence community resulted from any intelligence gathering exercise at all, as opposed to ordinary research. Indeed, a browse through the local media on the reported factions in the ruling party would easily enable one to make the same conclusions. Anyway, it's just about that judgment. The court ruled, and that's an important ruling, that that the state has to work a little harder to prevent journalists using reports that are leaked to them. And so it was a victory, I think, for press freedom. But what the judge is saying is that the information in the report put together by the state security agency was so poor, you could have actually got it by reading the newspapers. Anyway, critics may not appreciate this as they try to have columnists removed for irritating them for not being experts in everything they write about. We love a response, good or bad. So I thank the angry tweeters who devoted so much time in trying to bash me. Shame, ladies and gentlemen, you missed the point about the business I'm in. I like what you did, so I'm very happy about that. I wouldn't be, however, so flippant about Naledi Pandor, the Minister of International Affairs and Cooperation, who wrote in the same Sunday Times a long letter about my previous column on our deteriorating relations with the United States. I think she's a pretty good minister in a difficult job, trying to be friends with countries who despise each other and trying to pretend that our warming ties to Russia and Iran are not problematic in the US when they so clearly, so obviously, so blindingly are. Which is what I'd written more or less the previous week. The column was triggered by an article in the Washington Post by President Cyril Ramaphosa, something I said should have been done by the diplomats in Washington. But only the problem being that we didn't have anybody in Washington with any clout, with any authority. Not true, said Naledi Pandor in her letter. The main item in the letter's column, which is a very, very prestigious position in the newspaper. We had Ambassador Ndumiso Nchingo on the ground, but she failed to mention that he's there in an acting position. He's a chargé d'affaires and has, in fact, retired. It means he'll be unable to build up the necessary political clout on the ground no matter what his experience as a diplomat, that would be required of any South African ambassador in Washington at arguably this most testing of times. He's going to be replaced after the May 29 election. He's only been there since November, following the early departure due to illness of Noma Indium Faketo, who was also a very dubious appointment to Washington in the first place. We have weak diplomats, it's a fact, in Washington when we need strong ones. And now Lady Pandor took great offense at me pointing this out. Anyway, she quite reasonably went on to misinterpret and distort what I had said in my column in order to make her final point, which I'll come to in a moment. She says that in criticizing our ties to Russia and Iran, which I'm perfectly entitled to do, they are violent countries who abuse their own helpless citizens, and pointing out that a bill passing through Congress seeking a review of U.S. ties with South Africa, I'm suggesting that South Africa should defer to the U.S. No, that's not true. I wasn't. She also writes that the belief concerning the three countries mentioned, this is Iran, Russia, and China, appears to be that South Africa must be the enemy of any enemy of the U.S. This is clearly muddled and absurd. But I never said that. All I had said, to make the obvious point, is that if you choose to cozy up to America's sworn enemies, then you'd better be prepared for the consequences. It's hardly a revolutionary observation. But neither Pandor nor Ramaphosa are able to accept that so far, and perhaps a thick skin is required in politics. Anyway, she ends off her letter with this real doozy. All this is most disappointing from a regular writer, she says, who should know better. It makes one wonder why such writing and misrepresentation deserves a free, regular column. Well, there you go, Minister. Fire the journalist. He didn't take me seriously. He didn't report me exactly in the way that I thought. And obviously, I've had to distort what he said in order to make this letter short and impactful. But get rid of him. I'm sure people like the minister frequently bump into the editors of the big newspapers like the Sunday Times, and I'm sure my name will come up next time she does. I'd be worried if she wasn't trying to get me fired, frankly, and I'm unlikely to forget it. If she really does think that getting rid of journalists who don't write or who write critically about them, she's probably in really good company in Russia and Iran and China. I remember as a young man bumping into Pandor's dad, Joe Matthews, in a shop he ran in Gaborone, Botswana. This would have been in about 1997 or so. I'd gone in to buy a Coca-Cola, I think, and we had a wonderful chat. He was a really lovely man. Somewhere there's a photograph of that meeting. I doubt I'd get a selfie now with his daughter, and not that I'd want one. These are the waters, though, that I choose to swim in. They're warm, and it's pleasant. It's crazy, but I do what I do, because I trust the newspapers and audiences I write and broadcast for, and I hope they trust me. The moment people stop reading what I write, I assume they'll turf me out, and that'll be fine. Careers in journalism seldom end gracefully. Like I said, it was 50 years ago, pretty much around now, that I first got a real job in a newspaper. I loved journalism from the first minute I walked into that newsroom, and I still do with a fierce passion. And the people we write about are not the ones that matter, even though we make them famous. It's you who matter, listeners and readers. Publishers and editors who forget that, well, they eventually lose. I never forget it. That's me done for this week, and I hope you'll enjoyed listening, and I'll be back next week. Please stay safe. Don't worry too much about everything. The South African story will eventually end well. I promise. Bye-bye.